All right, welcome to the deep dive, everybody. Today we're taking a look at, well, I'd say a fascinating case out of the Third Circuit. It's United States versus James Garner from 2019. And, you know, you marked this as like particularly insightful for us to kind of dig into. And yeah, looking at all the stuff that you sent over, I can definitely see why. This one really takes us into like right to the core of some big criminal law ideas.
Yeah, it does. This case is like a mashup of conspiracy and attempt. And we've even got some firearm possession stuff going on, all in a single appeal. So for you listening, we are going to break down those core principles that we see coming out of this decision and talk about, you know, why they matter.
For sure. I mean, we're going to be wrestling with some pretty fundamental questions here, right? Like, can you actually be found guilty of trying to rob a bank, even if you never even like stepped foot inside? What happens when your, you know, your partner in crime is secretly working with the FBI? And then when a jury comes back with a verdict, what kind of scrutiny does that verdict get from a higher court?
Right. And for our law students out there, think of this as like a super condensed seminar. You know, Garner is like the textbook example of how courts look at the sufficiency of evidence, the often super tricky area of conspiracy law, and especially the line between getting ready for a crime and taking that quote unquote substantial step towards actually doing it.
Okay, so let's dive in. So James Garner, he was charged with a bunch of serious stuff. We're talking conspiracy to commit armed bank robbery. We're talking attempting to commit armed bank robbery and possessing a firearm in furtherance of a crime of violence.
Wow.
This all went to trial in Pennsylvania. A jury found him guilty on all counts. Now, what we're diving into today is his appeal to the Third Circuit, basically his argument that there wasn't enough evidence to back up those guilty verdicts.
Exactly. He's saying, hey, the prosecution, they didn't prove their case. So to really get what the Third Circuit decided, we need to lay out what happened, the facts of the case.
Right. Okay. So the story goes, Garner, he recruits two people to help him rob Apex Bank. One was Saber. And here's the kicker. Saber was actually working with the FBI the whole time.
Oh, wow. All
right. The other guy was Reuben Marshall. And the stuff you sent over points to some pretty incriminating evidence against Garner.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've got these recorded conversations. You can literally hear Garner telling Saber very specific instructions, like go scope out the bank, figure out when employees get there. You know, the kind of details you would need to actually rob the place.
Yeah. Sounds a little more than just casual conversation.
Yeah, way more.
And it wasn't just talk with Saber. Garner also met up with Marshall, you know, hammering out the details of their plan.
Yeah.
Then February 12, 2015 rolls around. Law enforcement, they step in. Garner's arrested. And when they catch him, he's got a bag. And in that bag, there's a loaded gun. There's ski masks, gloves, two-way radios. I mean, come on. Doesn't exactly scream innocent bystander, does it?
No, not at all. That's like robbery starter kit right there. And here's another twist that's super important, especially when we get to the conspiracy charge. At trial, Reuben Marshall, Garner's co-defendant, he was acquitted on everything. So keep that in mind as we go forward.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So we've got the charges. We've got the basic rundown of what went down.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk law now.
Mm-hmm.
What were those key legal standards that the Third Circuit had to consider when Garner appealed his case?
All right. So there are a few big legal players here. First up, we have what's called sufficiency of the evidence.
Right.
Basically, it's the standard that an appeals court uses to decide if there was enough evidence presented at trial for a reasonable jury to find the defendant guilty. And we're talking beyond a reasonable doubt here. This standard, it comes from a Supreme Court case called Jackson versus Virginia. And the really important thing here is that the appeals court has to look at all the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution.
Okay.
They're not retrying the case.
Right.
They're not second-guessing the jury.
So it's not about whether the Third Circuit judges personally think Garner's guilty. It's about whether a reasonable jury, looking at the evidence, could have reached that guilty verdict.
Exactly. And they're not going to overturn a jury's decision just because, you know, maybe there's another possible explanation for the evidence.
Okay, that makes sense. So then we have the legal standard for attempt. To find Garner guilty of attempted bank robbery, the prosecution had to show that he took a substantial step towards actually robbing the bank. So he didn't have to finish the crime, but his actions had to, you know, pretty clearly show that he was on his way to doing it.
Right. And this substantial step test, this is where it gets kind of tricky, right? Like, what exactly is the substantial step and how is that different from just, you know, getting ready to commit a crime.
Right, right.
Like, what's the line there? So the court, they look at whether the defendant's actions clearly show that they had criminal intent. Just buying, you know, like a baseball cap, that could be used in a robbery. That's probably not enough. But if you combine that with, like, you know, casing the joint, getting specific tools for the crime, especially a loaded gun, and coordinating with others, that starts to look a lot more like a substantial step.
Hmm.
What's really interesting about this substantial step idea is how much it depends on the specific facts of the case.
Yeah.
The law, it doesn't give you like a checklist. You know, it's not like do these five things and boom, it's attempt. It's more about looking at the whole picture, how close the person came to actually committing the crime and how clear their intent was.
That makes sense. It's not enough to just have bad thoughts. You got to actually do something that moves you significantly closer to doing the crime. Okay, and the third legal standard we got to talk about is conspiracy. What needs to be proven for that charge to stick?
So for conspiracy, the prosecution, they got to prove three things. First, there was an agreement between two or more people to commit a crime. Here, it's armed bank robbery. Second, the defendant, Garner, he intentionally joined in on that agreement. And third, at least one of the people involved took an overt act to further the conspiracy. Now, the Third Circuit, they made it clear that all of this can be proven with what we call circumstantial evidence.
Okay.
So when we talk about circumstantial evidence, we mean evidence that doesn't directly prove something, but lets you infer something based on other evidence. Like, let's say you got these repeated secret meetings and everyone's coordinating their actions. That can lead a jury to believe, hey, these guys are probably agreeing to commit a crime. You don't need a signed contract that says, we agree to rob this bank on this date.
Right. The jury can piece it together from the circumstances, from what people were doing, what they were saying. And then we have the firearm charge, which falls under this federal law, 18 U.S.C., section 924C. What's the standard there?
So this law basically says it's a separate crime to have a gun in furtherance of a violent crime. In Garner's case, those underlying violent crimes were the conspiracy to commit armed bank robbery and the attempted bank robbery. And this firearm charge, it comes with a mandatory minimum sentence, which we'll get into a little bit later. But the key here is that it's a pretty high bar to clear.
Right.
And that reflects something fundamental about our legal system. We really respect the jury's role as the fact finder. Unless the evidence is so weak that no reasonable person could find the defendant guilty, the appeals court is going to stick with the jury's decision.
Okay, so those are the legal rules of the game, the framework that the Third Circuit had to work within. Now, let's get into how they actually analyzed Garner's case, starting with that conspiracy charge. This is where Marshall's acquittal gets really interesting, right? How can Garner be guilty of conspiring with someone who was found not guilty of being part of the same conspiracy? And what about Saber, the informant? How does that play into it?
Right. This is a super important point, and it takes us into like the nitty-gritty of conspiracy law. The Third Circuit, they addressed this head on. They said, look, if the only agreement Garner had to rob the bank was with Saber, the informant, that wouldn't be enough to prove conspiracy. And the reason for that is an informant, they're not really in it to commit the crime.
Right.
They're there to help law enforcement. So for a real conspiracy, there has to be an agreement with someone who actually wants to commit the crime.
Okay, that makes sense. You need two people who are both on board with breaking the law, not just one person and someone pretending to be.
Mm-hmm.
So if Marshall was acquitted, where did the Third Circuit find the evidence for a real conspiracy in Garner's case?
This is where those recorded conversations between Garner and Marshall become super important. The court, they said, those recordings, that's enough evidence for a reasonable jury to find that there was an agreement between Garner and Marshall to rob the bank. They were talking about the plan, the logistics, who was going to do what. Even though Marshall ended up being acquitted, maybe the jury had some doubts about his intent or how much he was really involved. The court said there was enough evidence to show that there was an agreement there.
So even if one person is found not guilty of conspiracy, the other person can still be convicted if there's separate evidence showing they had an agreement with at least one other person who wasn't just an informant or someone who was cleared of wrongdoing.
Exactly. And the Third Circuit, they even quoted a specific legal principle in their opinion. They said, quote, each element of conspiracy may be proven entirely by circumstantial evidence. And they went on to say that the conclusions the jury drew had a logical and convincing connection to the facts established. So basically, they're saying, look, the evidence about Garner's talks with Marshall, that meets the legal standard for proving conspiracy.
Okay, got it. So to circle back to our earlier question, it sounds like the Third Circuit is saying Yeah, you can be found guilty of attempted bank robbery even if you never set foot in the bank, as long as you take these substantial steps towards committing the crime.
Exactly. The court, they were pretty straightforward in their analysis here. They looked at everything Garner did and they said, yep, he took substantial steps. He went way beyond just planning or thinking about it. They pointed out a few specific things. First, Garner told Saber to go check out the bank, get the intel they needed to pull off the robbery. Second, he got the tools for the job, the loaded gun, the masks, gloves, radios. And third, he was actively telling Saber what his role was going to be in the robbery.
So it wasn't just like theoretical talk. He was taking real actions, concrete steps to actually rob the bank. What if, like hypothetically, Garner had only been caught with the ski mask and gloves, no gun, and just some vague conversations about robbing a bank? Would that have been enough for the substantial step?
That's a good question. I mean, in that scenario, it would have been way harder for the prosecution to prove that substantial step. You could explain away a ski mask and gloves pretty easily, and vague talk doesn't necessarily prove you're going to act. But in Garner's case, they had the specific tools, the detailed planning, the instructions he gave, all of that together, it really painted a clear picture of his intent.
Right. The court even quoted a legal principle in their opinion. They said, quote, "A defendant may commit an attempt even where he stops short of the last act necessary for the crime." So they're saying it's not about actually finishing the crime, it's about taking those concrete steps that show you were seriously trying to do it.
Right. And they emphasized that Garner's actions showed without a doubt that he intended to rob the bank.
So the court was basically drawing a line between those specific actions and more general preparations, like just saying you want to rob a bank, or maybe buying something that could be used in a robbery, but isn't necessarily a dead giveaway that you're planning a bank robbery. The key difference seems to be how directly connected the actions are to the specific crime you're planning.
Exactly. What Garner did wasn't just like getting ready in a general sense. It was all part of the specific plan to rob that particular bank.
Okay, and last but not least, let's talk about that firearm charge. Since the court upheld the convictions for conspiracy and attempted bank robbery, what was their reasoning on the firearm charge?
They kept it pretty simple on this one. They said, look, we've already decided that Garner is guilty of conspiracy to commit armed bank robbery and attempted armed bank robbery. Both of those count as violent crimes under the law. So when they arrested him with a loaded gun, along with all the other robbery gear, that clearly backs up the charge of possessing a firearm in furtherance of those violent crimes. The fact that he has a loaded gun right there with the other stuff you'd need for a bank robbery, that pretty much says it all. It was meant to be used during the robbery.
Right. It wasn't just that he happened to have a gun on him. The context, all those other items connected to a bank robbery, that made it clear that the gun was part of the plan.
Exactly. And as we mentioned before, this charge comes with a mandatory minimum sentence of 60 months, 5 years, and that's served on top of any other sentence he gets.
Okay, so big picture. What are the key takeaways from United States versus James Garner for our listeners, especially those of you studying law?
So, there are a few really important lessons here. Number one, there's this idea of appellate deference, which basically means that appeals courts really respect the jury's decision on the facts of the case. This case really drives that point home. Appeals courts aren't going to overturn a jury's verdict unless there's practically no evidence to support it. Even if there might be other ways to interpret the evidence, as long as there's enough to support the jury's decision, they're going to uphold it. And the Third Circuit actually said this in their opinion, quote, "Reversing the jury's conclusion simply because another inference is possible or even equally plausible is inconsistent with the proper standard of review."
Right.
So this really shows how important the jury is in our legal system. They're the ones who decide what the facts are.
Yeah, they're the ones who actually weigh the evidence and make the call. The appeals court's job is more about making sure the law was applied correctly and that there was enough evidence to support the jury's decision.
That's exactly. Takeaway number two. This case gives us a really clear example of how conspiracy works when you have informants involved. You can't be convicted of conspiracy if the only person you're agreeing with is a government informant.
Right.
But if you have at least one other person who is genuinely in on the plan to commit the crime, then the agreement with that person is enough for a conspiracy charge, even if other people involved turn out to be informants or are found not guilty. And here's what the court said about that. Quote, "Merely conspiring with a government informant would not make Garner liable. But here, the evidence showed a broader agreement involving Marshall. So this idea of a real meeting of the minds, that's super important in conspiracy law.
That's a really key point for anyone studying criminal law to understand. It has to be a real agreement to do something illegal.
Absolutely. And takeaway number three, this case shows us, in black and white, what a substantial step means when we're talking about attempt crimes. It's not about having thoughts or making vague plans. It's about taking actions that really show you're going to do the crime. You're going beyond just preparing. The focus is on actions that support your intent to commit the specific crime. Like in Garner's case, he did detailed surveillance on the bank, and he got all the tools he needed for the robbery.
So United States versus James Garner gives us a really practical look at how these legal ideas, the sufficiency of evidence, conspiracy, and the substantial step in attempt cases, how they actually work in real life.
Totally. It's a great case study for understanding how courts analyze the evidence and apply these legal standards.
Yeah, for sure. Well, this has been a really insightful look into the James Garner case. It's definitely cleared up some tricky areas of criminal law.
I agree. And it reminds us just how much weight is given to jury verdicts and what exactly needs to be proven for conspiracy and attempt charges to stick.
Right. Now, as you think about this case some more, I want you to consider this. Looking at all the evidence, what specific piece of information do you think really convinced the jury that Garner was guilty of attempted bank robbery? What stood out to them? It's a great exercise to think like a juror and try to figure out what evidence is most persuasive. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening.